Bohemia podcast, where me, Nicole Byer, tries to figure out how I'm still single, even though if you stole all of my sconces out of my house, I would say, oh, I guess it's dark, but I still love you. My guest today is a stand-up comedian, actor, writer from England. She's been a featured correspondent on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. She co-created and stars in the CBS sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola. I think I said it right.
Yeah.
Abishola.
Just read the letters.
Abishola.
Yep.
Abishola. It's Gina Yashirai.
Perfect.
So do you live? Where do you live? In England or are you here in the States?
I am in Altadena, California. I'm in Los Angeles, baby.
I love it. Altadena, what a beautiful bougie place.
We love it here. We love it. We were in North Hollywood and then the pandemic hit and then it became like the zombie apocalypse. And my missus was like, we got to get up out of here. So we moved to peace and quiet and we love it.
I do love a little neighborhood vibe.
Oh, so do I.
A little like I'm close to the city, but I'm far enough away.
Yeah.
I was just in New York, which is the city. And
I love New York. I was there for 6 years. I had no plans to come back to LA. TV brought me back here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the show, Bob Hart's Abishola, brought me back to LA. I was happy in New York.
Oh, I do love New York. I tried to empty out a storage unit that I had in New York that I've had for like a decade now because I was like, I'm going to move back to New York. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not. Let's just empty it. I get there and I realize I forgot the key to the storage unit. So I asked the lady, the meanest lady in all of New Jersey. I said, excuse me, can I just cut the lock off? She was like, yeah, if you damage the door, you got to pay for it. And I was like, all right. So go to Home Depot, cut the lock off, open it. And I was with a friend and I realized that it was not my unit. I had opened the wrong one.
Oh
so
my
I
God.
Go back to the meanest lady in New Jersey to be like, oh, I made a mistake. And she was like, oh my God. So, you know, it's things are hard. Everything's very hard. Gina, you said the missus. So, Mary?
Yeah, lesbianity. Not marriage. But as good as.
I love that you're like, yes, lesbian. And I'm just like, married?
Not married. We've been together for 8 years. 12, but it's on the horizon. I just hate pomp and ceremony. I hate ceremonies. We're as good as. We have a house together. We've got two dogs. Those are our children. Mm-hmm. Our finances are... We are as good as.
How did you guys meet?
I was performing at Mitch Fest, Michigan Women's Festival. It has been featured on the L Word and Transparent and other shows. It's a big women's festival in the middle of Michigan. And it's music, it's poetry, it's comedy, it's all of that good stuff. And it's women running around with their tits out, muffs hanging, flaps out, the whole shebang lang. No men. Whenever a man comes on land to either change the toilet stuff, because it was all porta potties and stuff, they'd shout, man on the land! That kind of place. So I was booked to perform there back in 2013. And I don't do camping. I'm not one of those people. So I said to them, and it's a big thing, all the women go there camping. And I was like, I'll come and do the show, but you're going to have to put me in a hotel down the street. And you're going to have to bus me in every day because I do not sleep on the earth. Okay.
I feel you. So that's why I had a problem with nap time in kindergarten. I was like, you want me to sleep on the floor on a mat? Get real. I have a home.
Exactly. Exactly. So they were bussing me in every day to do the shows. And on the first day I came in, Nina, that's my missus, Gina and Nina. You sound ridiculous.
Aww.
I begged her to change her name. She won't have it. She was standing there. She was there with Gloria Bigelow, another comedian who is also her best friend. And I pulled up on the bus, I got off, and Nina was standing there with Gloria, and she was like, oh, Gloria, this is Gina Yashirai. I watched her special. This is the woman I was telling you about. She's really funny, talking about me. And I'm like, oh, great, nice to meet you. And she was like, let me show you around. And she just kind of grabbed my hand and pulled me off to show me around the area. And we were just pretty much inseparable after that. I mean, I was living in New York at the time. And this is my... I was living in Los Angeles. I'd come from England to LA. I'd been in LA 6 years at that point, nothing happening for me career-wise, and I'm like, I'm a stand-up comic, I need to earn a living doing stand-up comedy, and in LA, doing a set at the Improv for an $8 check is not going to cut it.
It's not it.
So I said to all my friends, and over the last 7 years I've been living in LA, I've been going back to New York every year and just going for 3 or 4 weeks and coming back with more money than I earned in an entire year in LA. Mm-hmm. So I was like, in June 2013, I said to my friends, okay, I'm going to spend the next 12 months wrapping up my life in LA. I'm going to New York. I'm going to make a living. I'm going to New York. That was in June 2013. August 2013, I met Nina. And would you believe it? She happened to live in New York. So the universe, the universe was like, oh, we're going to make this happen. So we did long distance for the 9 months or whatever it was of our relationship until my year was up. And I moved to New York and basically moved straight into Nina's house. Now, I was not planning to move in with her immediately. I was looking for apartments. And in LA, I was living quite nicely. I had a two-bedroom, two-bath in a building with a rooftop pool.
Uh-huh.
And I was paying $1,800 a month.
Yep.
And I expected to find the same thing.
Sure couldn't.
In New York. And Nina was like, you could try, but let me tell you, I've got a whole brownstone in Brooklyn. So when you finish your little dumb search, you can just move into my entire brownstone in Brooklyn. And yeah, after looking at a couple of apartments and going, you're charging $2,000 for a 200-square-foot cockroach-infested hovel. No, thank you. And so I moved in with Nina, and we've been happily ever after. And we were there happily for 6 years, and then TV brought me back to LA, and we were doing long distance again. And then COVID hit, and I called her, and I was like, get on a plane and get out to LA right now, because the world's about to shut down. And she flew out, and the world shut down the day after she flew out. And so she's been in LA ever since, and we ended up selling the house in Brooklyn, and we are now in LA. This is us.
I love it. This is us on NBC.
This is us, baby.
I really fucking love that, like, you guys had a long distance relationship, moved in together, and it was just, I don't know, I guess enough communication happened during your long distance relationship that made living together an easy transition. Or was it not an easy transition?
No, we just got on really well, because this is why I didn't want to live together immediately, because I don't like living with people. Mm-hmm. I'm very particular about my stuff. I'm a little bit of a clean freak. So I wasn't sure it was going to work. But here's the thing. I moved to New York in June and then immediately went on a 3-month tour. In fact, I never even made it to New York. I packed my car full of all my stuff and then had my car shipped to New York.
Oh.
And then I was on a 3-month tour, and Nina unpacked my entire car by herself and moved me into her house. And I was like,
damn, that's love.
In my absence. And I was like, this one's a keeper.
Oh, I fucking love that. So Nina is not a comic.
Nina is not a comic. She is a professor.
Oh.
At John Jay College of New York. So the last couple of years, she's been doing her classes online. So she's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. So she's in interdisciplinary studies, but what she really is concentrating on is teaching the police officers, lawyers, scientists of the future to stop killing Black people and stop. So that's her mission.
Oh, I mean, honestly, what a nice mission. Thank you, Nina.
Thanks, Nina.
What's it like dating a professor? Like, were you intimidated at all? I feel like I would be.
Not at all. We had really great conversations. I learned a lot from her. So I'm a person, I'm not intimidated by other people with high intelligence. If you know more than me, by all means, let me hear it. I want to learn from you. So I learned a lot about, and she's a white woman. It's hilarious. She's white, but she knew more about American history and the American history of racism, stuff like that, in this country than I did, because I'm from England. And similar experiences, but different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't have things like redlining.
Oh.
In England. Yes, there was racist housing policies, for sure, but not written into the Constitution like it was in America. So she taught me a lot of stuff about the history of racism and racial relations or whatever in America. So I learned a lot from her. So I was intimidated. I was really interested. So we had really good conversations, and obviously I taught about my history and where I come from. And it was just a meeting of the minds. And we also had fun. She's not a boring professor. She's a fun person. But she made me do things like fucking hiking and bike cycling and shit like that, which I was never interested in. She's still trying to force me to camp. We've been on a couple
like,
of camping
I'm
trips.
I'm an ally. I know about racism, but I would like you to hike and be outside a bit.
So she's forced me into various activities. But you know what? It's opened me up to stuff that I've never thought I was interested in, and now I love. I don't love hiking, and I'm never going to love camping. But I did enjoy the cycling, and I do enjoy the swimming now. I would never swim before.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm not interested in swimming, and I like getting wet, and I like it. But then we have our own pool now, and I realised it's just because I was a germaphobe. I didn't like swimming in other people's pools. Now I've got my own pool. Oh, I'm in that shit every day. So she's opened up my mind.
I love this. So is your relationship, was that inspiration for your show, which is about a white man who falls in love with a Nigerian woman?
Not at all. The whole show idea came from Chuck Lorre. I just came in and made it good and made it authentic. Chuck Lorre called me in for a meeting. So Chuck loved Billy Gardell. And he made Mike and Molly with Billy Gardell. And he wanted another project from Billy Gardell, but he didn't want to make another Mike and Molly. And he'd just come from a trip to Africa. He'd gone all over Africa, and he met beautiful people. And it was in the middle of Trump era when the craziness and the xenophobia and the racism was out of control. And it was Chuck's idea. He was like, I want to make a show where I'm going to make the female protagonist a Nigerian immigrant. Totally his idea. But then he was like, I don't know how to do this. I'm a white guy who's not really had that any experience. I need someone to help me create this. And so him and his two executive producers went about basically looking for someone that can help them make the show. And basically what they did was Google Nigerian female comedians. I'm not even joking.
Google is a fucking friend.
And I was the best one that came up. And they flew me over from New York for a meeting. And I was very suspicious, obviously, so suspicious that I told my agent to turn it down. But then luckily I have a best friend and brother in England who will call me up and tell me I'm being a fucking idiot when I'm being a fucking idiot. So then I stayed and basically a meeting that was supposed to be one day of me going back to New York turned into me staying in a room with Chuck Lorre and two white guys for 3 weeks writing a pilot.
Had you written for television before?
No, I'd refused at this point because all my career I was like, I'm a stand-up comic, and I'd heard horror stories about being the only black person in a writer's room. So I'd avoided the writer's room, and I was like, I don't want a day job. I'm a stand-up comic. I make a good living traveling the world doing what the hell I want, working for myself and not answering to anybody and making my little specials, and that's what I want to do forever. I do not want a day job. I don't want to be in a writer's room. I don't want to be involved in office politics. I don't want none of that shit. So I'd avoided. I'd written on a sketch show in England very early on in my career, and that cemented
your thoughts on how I don't want to fucking do that.
Exactly. So I hadn't written on a TV show. I just was not interested. And that was part of the reason why I turned it down, because it was also my fear of going back into that environment. But you know, my brother and best friend screamed at me and were like, this is an opportunity. You've been complaining about the lack of opportunity for black women in your industry. You've been trying to pitch shows for years and nobody buying. And here's an opportunity to make a show with the king of sitcoms. And you're saying, no, are you fucking... Anyway, you're an idiot. That's what I'm going to say. Are you an idiot?
Did you have like a say in how the room was popular, the writer's room, like on who was hired and whatnot?
I did. I did it in a way that was non-confrontational, what I did. So, you know, I helped them write the pilot, then the pilot got picked up. And so then I was like, because when we're writing the show, I was like, if we're going to do this show, you've got to listen to me. If I say black people don't do this, or we don't speak like this, or this is a stereotype, or this is racist, please believe me. Please believe me, or this show is going to be dead in the water. So, and I could tell that they were interested and wanted to listen. So that was a good start. And then when we were doing the writer's room, I was like, we can't have the same old white guys that you're used to writing these shows. We need to populate this room with more black writers and more, definitely more women. No, I'm not going to be the only woman in this room. Mm-hmm. I'm not having it. And they were like, and so what I would do every time I had a show, like I was headlining a show at Flappers in Burbank, and I was like, come to the show, come see me do some comedy. And then when they came to the show, I called up all my black friends and all my female friends, and I was like, come open for me. I didn't tell them what it was.
Uh-huh.
I said, come open for me at Flappers. So my friends came and opened for me. And then I called Gloria Bigelow, Nina's best friend. I said, come open for the show. Didn't say anything, what it was about.
Uh-huh.
She came and did a set. And Eddie and Al had come to the show. And they were like, oh, we really liked that girl, Gloria. She was funny. And I was like, well, she writes.
I mean, honestly, this story is... there should be more stories like that. You know, white men who have power, who want to write different voices,
yes,
should find the voice to help them cultivate it, because now you get to go out into the world as a creator of a show who can show run and is at an EP level,
yes, or an
executive producer level, if you don't know. And like, that's being an ally. That's how, yes, you cause change.
That's my joy. That's my joy.
Gina, like, I mean... I love that you got the opportunity, but then you didn't say, it's just me. You went, oh, let me get the other fucking people up in here. And yeah. I just fucking love that. And you're on season 3, right?
Oh, yeah. And we just got picked up for season 4. Got picked up early.
Congratulations. So like,
we're all over the moon. We got, you know, Gloria is here. She's season 4. She's in the writer's room. She just bought a house. Life is good. We got another young black Nigerian writer in the room, Ibet Inyang Banesh. She is a young Nigerian writer, very young. She's like, I'm not even, she's under 30. 26, mm-hmm, she was, I think, when she came into the writer's room. So she's in. We got a guy called Jamarcus Turner, who we found in a factory in Indiana.
Huh.
He was working, building gas tanks in a factory in Indiana. His script ended up on the table, on our table, and I said to Al, this guy's funny. This is, where else is a black guy who works in a factory in Indiana going to get a chance to write on primetime TV?
I love it.
Let's give him a chance. And now he's in the writer's room. We've got a nice mix of people. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, we've got an Italian woman. We've got some white guys. We've got a nice mix. And that's what I love.
Yeah, what a dream. I really love this. I feel like that's how like all jobs should, and they're not. It's a lot of gatekeeping, a lot of like hard to get in. And it's just like, if you give people opportunities, one, it might not work out, but that's the worst thing that happens. Best thing that happens is you like someone gets a career out of it, and someone gets to have like a better fucking life doing what they want to do.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And I always said to Al and Chuck and Eddie, I was like, look, listen, you guys were lucky you found me. Hmm. I am not the only me out there. Let me find you other me's, and you guys will make even more money.
I mean, inclusion is in everyone's best interest, because then it's like you get to reach different people by having different voices, and then you get to make more money.
Yeah, and Chuck's got a show now. He loves our show. It's exciting to him because he's never done a show like this before. Mm-hmm. This is the first show that Chuck has ever done where over half the cast is black and Nigerian at that.
Yes, and like actual Nigerians. Like, yeah, right?
And it was Chuck whose idea it was to have Kofo and Goodwin, the guys that work in Bob's Warehouse, who speak Yoruba, and subtitle it. I wouldn't even have thought to do that, because I would have been like, oh, white people watching this, they're not going to... Chuck was like, no, we're going in, let's do it, let's go in. And it was his idea. So he's excited by the new opportunities to make new types of television. And our show is groundbreaking. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
I love it so much. Real quick, we have to take a break.
Good, I can get more food in my face while we're taking this break.
It is a quick break, because we're back.
Oh, shit. Let me swallow this food.
So just to, like, go back to love for a little bit.
Let's go back to love.
What was dating like before you met Nina? Were you on dating apps? Because it was 2013, so I think dating apps were a thing.
I never did dating apps.
Oh, God bless. How lucky.
Yeah, and I feel so blessed to not have to go through that internet gamut of judgment and lookism and racism and sexism and fatism and whatever you think. No.
It is awful.
I feel terrible for all you singles out of the world who have to navigate this. It's horrible. And this is why I'm never letting Nina go.
I mean, it's a very good reason besides love.
Besides love. But yeah, dating for me, I mean, when I moved to, I've never been a serial dater.
Oh.
I'm a serial monogamist.
Mm-hmm.
I never did lots of dating. I don't. And this is how I found most of my partners. They usually approach me and I go, oh, I never know when people like me. I'm useless. I'm confident in every other aspect of my life. I'm outspoken with my work. I know I'm good at what I do. I'm confident. Anybody meets me, go, oh, that girl is super confident. But when it comes to getting girlfriends, not that confident. I said, people like me and I don't realise until they flash their tits at me, whatever. I really don't know. So the majority of my girlfriends have been people who have gone, I like you. And I go, oh, really? Oh, okay. All right then. All right, let's give this a go. And that's how it's been for the majority. And so, but when I was living in LA, I never dated any women in LA. I shouldn't even say it, but I found a lot of them so vacuous. And so when I was in LA, most of my girlfriends all came from Oakland. I imported them in from Oakland. So I had girlfriends from Oakland. And they were all, yeah, both these girls approached me. And that's the thing, I think the last girlfriend I had that I approached myself was 20 years ago.
Wow.
We ended up being together for 7 years, but then after that, it was all girls that were like, I like you. And I'm like, oh, well, then let's try this.
7 years is a long time. So, yeah, you go from relationship to relationship.
Yeah, so we ended, and then I take a break. Then I had a couple of short-lived relationships with crazy women from Chicago.
Okay. Okay.
And I was like, no, this ain't going to work out. Another crazy woman from Oakland. This ain't going to work out. Then, and then Nina. and we've been together 8 years. So
I love that.
I attract mainly the long haulers, which is good.
I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to attract somebody who's like, in it to win it. I date people for like a couple months and then they're like, you know, I think we need to part ways. I've always been broken up with. I've never broken up with anybody.
Yeah, see, I think my attitude in that, I'm like, oh, well, this is fine. If this works out, it works out. If it doesn't, I'm quite happy. That attitude makes people want to cling on to me a little bit more. You know, I'm not saying I play hard to get. I play games. I'm quite happy on my own. And people see that, and then they were like, oh, well, I want. And that's basically how I've managed to. And also, I have fun. I don't take it too seriously.
I think I could learn from that, just like not taking things too seriously. Yeah. Although I went on a date a while ago where I was like, oh, boy, I could go on a second date with this person, but I think I'd be really upset about it. I'm going to listen to myself and I'm not going to go out with them again. And they were like, let's go out again. And I was like, you know, I wish you the best, but I don't think this is it.
That's good. Come from a place of confidence in yourself and know that someone's out there for you and you ain't going to take second best. Just have fun. No.
Yeah, and it's just about fun.
Have fun with it. Be relaxed about it.
You said you have a brother? You have brothers? Brother?
Two brothers, yeah.
Where are they?
All my family's in England. I'm the only one who escapes. I've got two sisters as well, older sister, younger sister. Everybody's still in London. I'm the only one that got out.
Are they single?
My sisters are both single because they're both weirdos. That's a whole other story. You're going to have to read my book to find out about that.
Well, what's the name of your book? Let's promote that.
Oh, it's called Cat-Handed because I'm left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And cat-handed also means awkward and clumsy, which left-handed people tend to be. And it's also the fact that it also covers the fact that my career and life has taken unconventional routes, and that's why this is the book. I know we're not doing it's only audio, but it's available all good bookstores and on Amazon, and it's a good book. I got 5-star reviews on Amazon, people. It's a good book.
It's a good cover too. I like it. I like your outfit on the cover.
Yeah, it's kind of bright. It's me being me, you know. But yeah, so it's a memoir that covers my journey from being born in England, what I went through in England, the racism, misogyny, whatever. I used to be an engineer, all that stuff, coming to England. And it covers a little bit of my love life too. Not much, because it wasn't that active. I wasn't that exciting. But yeah, so I've got two sisters and two brothers. One brother is happily married, two kids. Him and his wife have been together, I'm going to say 20 years.
Damn.
Yeah. And my other brother, single? Newly single, but he's a player back in the day. He's the one of those guys. Three kids, three women. You know that.
Ooh,
but
yes.
But I've got to say, dad to all his kids, doting grandpa, and on good terms of all his baby mamas.
See, I like that. It's do what you want, but at least keep it civil, keep it nice.
Yeah.
So you said you used to be an engineer. What kind of engineer were you?
I used to build and repair elevators for Otis. I was the first female engineer that Otis in the UK had had in their 100-year history. Sounds great. It was horrible. First woman, surrounded by white men. Misogyny and racism abounded. You know, people always, you know, I always do these interviews where they go, as a woman in comedy, is it really hard? And I'm like, as an engineer, I used to come into work and there were bananas stuck in my coat pockets and pictures of monkeys put on the wall above my overalls. So, no.
That's fucking shitty. Yo, people are like, I don't know. I'm like, get a hobby. Like, how you? Why are you doing any of this shit? It's rude.
So rude. So that is also in the book. I went through a baptism of fire, as you were, but I came out the other side better, stronger.
I like that you have like an even, like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like you have a chip on your shoulder. You're just like, shit's happened, but you know, I keep moving forward.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've got a chip on my shoulder, but I'm aware of stuff that's going on. And I get angry. I get very angry. If you follow me on social media, I have my happy-go-lucky videos. And then one day I will do a rant. And I don't hold back. So, you know, I do get angry. I do get, you know, very irritated with what is going on in the world. And I hate the way this country's being run at the present time. And the people that are trying, you know, it's a bunch of white, greedy men enriching themselves at the expense of everybody and everything. But I also am of the belief that I want to make my own slice of happiness in my corner of the world. I can't spend too much time worrying about the world because I'll die of a stroke.
Yeah.
So I've got to balance it out.
Yeah, I think that's the key to life. Just a little bit of balance. It's okay to like, you know, look at the news, look at the world, but also it's like, what makes you happy?
Yeah.
So you don't drink.
I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do drugs. And yet, life and soul in the party, Nicole.
Can I ask you about, have you ever had a cocktail, a beverage?
Oh, yeah. I just never like the taste of it. I'm a sugar junkie. I love sweet things, chocolate, cakes, candies. That is my drug of choice. So if a drink is sweet and delicious, I'll partake. Like, I love a bit of Baileys at Christmas. I know I sound like an old lady. I don't give a shit. Baileys is fucking delicious. Love a bit of it. It's like ice cream in a cup. It's fucking beautiful. So I love, and there's my neighbor is Puerto Rican and she makes us this drink at Christmas. I think it's called Conchita. It's very similar to Baileys. It's a creamy alcoholic beverage and it's delicious. But that's it. I've never, you know, I've only ever been drunk once in my life. And I was like, why do people do this to themselves on a regular basis? I don't get it. So I just never caught the drinking bug. I like sweet, sugary things. And beer does not do that. Wine is disgusting to me. It just doesn't do anything for me. It's not through any moral code. I just don't like the taste. Drugs, I've smoked a bit of weed and whatever. Yeah, of course. But I don't do it on a regular basis because I don't like taking smoke into my lungs. Just don't like it.
Sure.
And I've also gotten a very addictive personality, so I've never tried coke because I know I would love it.
Yeah, it's a good time.
I would love it. I know I'd love it, and I know that I'd go overboard because that's how I do. I get addicted to things very quickly and very heavily, and I know that if I did coke, I would end up in an alleyway sucking off random dudes for a hit. I know how I will end up, so I'm not going to try it because I know myself too well.
I used to smoke I quit January 3rd.
Oh.
And for a minute I was like, but I want them. And now it's gotten to the point where I'm like, what did I like about them? They weren't nice. They weren't fun. They didn't make me feel good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I smoked for 3 weeks when I was 16.
Oh yeah? 3 weeks? And then you were like, this isn't for me.
Yeah, because I went to a school, which was a very cool school in London called Camden School for Girls. And I was 16, and they had a smoking room for the 16 to 18 year olds.
In school?
In school. They had a smoking room where the six, you know, they were like, you girls make your own decisions in life. And if you want to smoke, this is where you can smoke. And that's where all the cool girls hung out. So I used to go and hang out in the smoking room.
Was this school sponsored by Big Tobacco? What do you, like, that's truly insane. That's so wild.
It was a very highly rated school, and it still is. If you look up Camden School for Girls in London, it's a very highly rated school. But they believed in 16 to 18 year olds being having autonomy, you know, of their own bodies. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a smoker's room, and all the cool girls hang out in the smoker's room. So I used to go to the smoker's room, and obviously I started smoking with the cool girls. But then after 3 weeks, I was like, this is gross. It smells. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. Why the hell am I doing this? And I said, I'm giving up. I'll hang out with you guys in the airport. I'm not smoking. This is bullshit. And that was it. And I never smoked again.
Yeah, it is funny. I like when I was in New York, I went to New York earlier this week, and New York was, I lived there for 8 years and I smoked, and I, you know, it's like what I did. You drink, you smoke. And I was like, it feels so weird to not smoke as I'm walking the streets of New York. But then I like saw this guy smoking and I was like, oh, but like he smells. He smells like smoke. And he's not, it's not doing anything for him.
Exactly. Exactly.
I read this book, Alan Carr's The Easy Way to Quit Smoking. And usually I don't subscribe to like bullshit like that. But I was like, I don't know. This book truly helped me.
Because
it was like, you don't enjoy it. What do you like about it? And you're like, oh, I guess actually nothing. It's like, do you actually feel relaxed, or are you just feeding your addiction? And you're like, oh, I guess I'm relaxing because I was in withdrawal. And you're like, oh, no. What have I been doing?
Well, at least you made the change. You did it.
I did. Thank you so much. Also, are you vegan?
I am right now, yes. I'm not going to say I am vegan. I say I eat vegan.
Oh, okay. So you eat vegan right
now.
Yeah,
it's not a... I did it out of health, not out of choice. I love meat. Meat is delicious. I am African. And African people love me. But I suffer from lupus. I was diagnosed with lupus back in 2005, and I was very ill for a very long time, like to the point where I had a raised toilet seat. I struggled to walk, struggled to lift my arms above my head, to the point where the doctors were feeding me with steroids and all kinds of drugs and painkillers. And at one point, the doctors were like, we don't know what to do, so we're thinking maybe we'll try chemotherapy. And that's where I was like, okay, let's stop. You guys are experimenting on me like a guinea pig. I need to change my lifestyle. So then I started researching.
So doctors were like, we don't know what's wrong with you, let's give you chemo fucking therapy?
Yep. They're like, this lupus, we've tried all these drugs. It's basically that a chemotherapy is like a hard reset for your body and immune system. They just wipe out everything.
Oh,
and that's
God.
What they do when you have cancer. They wipe out everything to completely destroy your immune system and try and build you back up again. And I was like, I'm not doing that. And then I started researching alternative ways to heal yourself of illness. And I discovered raw veganism. I went raw vegan for about a year, and my lupus went into remission almost immediately.
Mm.
And I came off all my medication. And this was back in 2009. The doctor was like, you're crazy. You can't do this. You're going to die. Your body's going to go into shock.
Mm-hmm.
I've been off lupus medication since 2009, and I manage it with eating. Now, I haven't been 100% vegan the entire time because I'm one of those people, as I said, I've got addictive personality. Mm-hmm. I'll eat a lamb chop and I'll go, oh my God, lamb chops. And then I'll eat nothing but fucking lamb chops for 6 months. So I've been, you know, going up and down, up and down. But mm-hmm. I know when my body, my arthritis starts to come back. When I'm eating too badly, my arthritis starts to come back and the lupus symptoms start to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vegan lifestyle comes, you better come back. You better come back to us unless you want to end up back where you were in 2007. So, yeah, so I try and eat clean. And right now, clean for me is vegan. No meat, no animal products, no dairy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what happens to your body when you have lupus?
It can hit you in a myriad of different ways, because lupus is basically your immune system attacking everything. Your immune system cannot tell the difference between good cells and bad cells, so it attacks everything. It can attack your skin, it can attack your joints, it can attack your heart, lungs, liver, mm-hmm. kidneys, anywhere. So I had the worst type of lupus. Mine started attacking my kidneys at one point, attacked mm-hmm. my joints. So I had horrific arthritis for a very long time. Horrific. And it started to attack my kidneys. So I wanted to put a stop to it before the damage became irreparable. So then I changed my lifestyle and now my kidneys are functioning normal. The arthritis has gone away. You know, I can work. I was on the phone to my brother last night and he's like, I can't believe that you're better now than you were, like, you're 50 years old and you're better now than you were at 35.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember when you couldn't, I remember he goes to me one time, you were staying at my house and you were in the toilet for 45 minutes, he says to me, and he bangs on the door and goes, Gina, what are you doing in there? And I was like, I can't get off this seat. My arthritis was so bad that I couldn't get off the seat. And I was sitting in the toilet for 45 minutes because I couldn't get up. My mm-hmm. my knees were locked up. And now I'm playing pickleball. I'm swimming. I'm running. I'm, you know, and that's just from changing my lifestyle.
It is truly wild. If you change, like, a couple things that you're eating, even if you don't have, like, an illness, you just fucking feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's why I'm eating vegan. And that vegan food is so much better now. There's so many wonderful places. Mm-hmm. Like Tabitha Brown has just opened up a place in Encino.
She did?
Called Care of My Name. So I have got to go there.
I have to go there too. I'm writing it down.
It looks
because
delicious.
Because I love her. She is so sweet and wonderful. I was vegan for like a solid 4 months.
Oh,
I felt better. My skin was better. I had more energy. I just love meat so much. I need to find a nice balance between eating meat and not eating meat.
Yeah.
Just for me and my body.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Real quick, we got to take another break.
Let's do it.
Okay, so tell me why you left the UK for America.
It's been my dream since I was a child. As a kid watching TV shows, I watched things like Different Strokes. Now, looking back at Different Strokes, it was very problematic. But as a kid watching it, I was like, I want to live in America and be adopted by a rich white man and live this amazing life. What? There's nothing wrong with that. And I watched shows where kids were riding around on cool bicycles in LA solving crimes. And I was like, I want to live by a beach and ride around solving crimes. So that was my dream as a child, being born in, raised in quite a poor area of London. I was born in the East End of London,
mm-hmm.
very working class, lot of immigration, lot of immigrants, lot of racism, skinheads and immigrants, not mm-hmm. a good combination.
No.
And so, you know, I'd be watching these TV shows all in America and going, these kids all live near beaches. Like, I want to go to America so I can live near a beach and hang out after school with Brad and Chad. And that was my dream. And that dream followed me all through my life. Even when I was working as an engineer, I worked for Otis, which I knew was an American company, mm-hmm. because my plan was to get enough experience as an engineer in England and then transfer and work for Otis in America. Mm-hmm. So it was my dream my entire life. My entire life, I was focused on somehow getting to America. Then I got into comedy and, you know, I was doing comedy in England and I got really good very quickly and I was quite successful. But then I hit a glass ceiling in mm-hmm. that. As a successful black comic, your level of success stopped at a certain level, whereas all my white peers went on to become multimillionaires selling out stadiums, and I stopped at a certain level. Mm-hmm. So I became very frustrated. And even when I started doing comedy, I made friends with like American comics that used to come and tour in England. Like I toured with JB Smoove.
I love
25
him.
Years ago, but you know, Will Sil Vince, you know, Ian Edwards. All those guys used to come to England mm-hmm. 20 years ago. So, and I toured with them at the beginning of my career. So I was friendly with them. So I, in the beginning of my comedy career, I'd fly out to New York on vacation and then hang out at the comedy clubs and do sets just to see if my stuff worked. And so I always knew that as a comedian, I, by hook or by crook, I was going to get to America. I don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And then Last Comic Standing came along and that was my ticket.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
I got through to the final of Last Comic Standing at the semifinals, and they got me a work visa. And it was a 2-year work visa. And I was like, this is a 2-year work visa. The show only can be filmed for another 4 weeks. What happens? Does that mean I can live and work in America for 2 years? And they're like, yeah, it's a 2-year work. So I went back to England for a weekend, put my house on the market, sold and gave away everything I owned.
Holy shit.
And turned up in America with 2 suitcases to my name. I threw a massive party at the house that I was selling. And everybody was like, you're crazy. It's just a TV. You're going to have to come back. And I was like, trust me. I ain't coming back. I'm going to turn this into something. You ain't seen me again. And yeah, 2 years later, I got my green card. And I was gone. I was gone.
That's so fucking funny. You're like, fuck this, goodbye. And everyone's like, you're crazy. Yeah, and it's like, you're fucking crazy if you think I'm fucking coming back, goodbye.
Exactly.
How did you get into comedy? What led you there?
So when I left engineering, I left after 4 years working for Otis. Couldn't bear it anymore. I was taking a break. I took voluntary redundancy, so they paid me off. I said to them, make me redundant or else I'm going to make public all the racism and misogyny within this company.
Wait, make me redundant? That. What does that mean?
Lay me off with a payout.
Oh.
Because the building industry went through a slump in the mid-90s and they were laying people off. But they were not laying me off because I was their diversity hire kind of thing. They had me on all their brochures going, look, we got a black person and a woman. All in one. Look at this. So I was on all their fucking brochures. So and I was a good engineer. So I was good at my job. And I ticked a load of boxes. So they were not going to lay me off. But I was done with it at this point because I was not getting the promotions I was supposed to get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd give me the money and they'd give me the promotion in name. And I'm like, but I'm supposed to be running my own site now. Why am I not running my own site? And they're like, well, we don't think guys will listen to girls. So we'll give you the promotion because you deserve it. But we're not going to give you the responsibility that goes with that promotion. So that's what I was up against for a long time. And at one point, I took them to a grievance hearing. I went to the top bosses, filled it. And I was like, this is discrimination. My union, who I've been paying into for 4 years, refused to represent me at this hearing.
What the fuck? That's so fucking wild.
Yeah, my union rep went, we don't know about this women's lib stuff. Those were his actual words. Those were his actual words, my union rep. I don't know about this women's lib stuff. So.
That is truly incredible.
Yeah, so I went to this hearing, 21 years old, alone, unrepresented. And obviously I lost because I was up against a panel of old white men who went, we don't think we're doing anything wrong. Do you think we're doing anything wrong? No. What about you, chat? No? Okay. No, we're not doing anything. On your way, young black woman. So I left. They were making me run it. I marched into my manager's office and I went, make me redundant. Lay me off with the 6-month payout. I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So they laid me off and they gave me a nice payout. So I spent the summer just hanging out, having fun. And people had always told me I was funny, you know, but I didn't see that as a career. I used comedy as a way to deflect from being in conflict because being an African kid at school, we were not cool. I got into fights a lot of school. People tried to bully me, so I'd fight a lot. And then, you know, I got fed up with beating people up. I was like, there must be another way to get out of conflict other than just being the craziest kid and just fighting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how my sense of humour, I started using comedy as a deflecting tool. So people always told me I was funny. I joined the Nation of Islam after I left Otis because that's what you do when you've been horribly abused by white people for a long time. I joined the Nation of Islam for that was very short-lived.
Yeah.
Very short-lived. It's all in the book. It's all in the book. Don't get the book. Man, that's the full story.
So fucking funny. So yeah. I'm keeping it fused by white people. He joined the Nation of Islam, you know?
Yeah, that's what I did.
Religion where they're like, we fucking hate white people. That's, oh man, that really got me good.
So it was very short-lived. It was under a year, but I joined the Nation of Islam. And then I learned a lot about my black history that they never taught us in school. That was a good thing about Nation of Islam. I learned a lot about how powerful black people were before slavery, that we are not defined by slavery. We were people before that. So then I started looking into more of that stuff, and I joined various organizations that were doing work in the community, and that's how I got into comedy. Because one day we were doing a fundraiser, and they were like, we need poets and dancers and singers and stuff. And so me and a couple of friends of mine were always messing around doing our mum's accents. You know, all of us were Nigerian, so we mess about talking to each other in our mum's Nigerian accents. So I wrote what I thought was a play for us to perform for this fundraiser. It was a play, that us playing our Nigerian mothers in this play. Turns out I've written a comedy sketch. Because people laughed their asses off. And I was like, and it was like a ka-ching moment. It was like, and then we started entering talent competitions with this one sketch that I wrote. And we kept winning these talent competitions. Just winning, win after win after win with this one sketch. Then one day, the other two girls were not that serious, but one day they didn't turn up for the semifinal of a competition that we were in. One of them had been burgled and the other one had gone to help her. And this was in 95 or something. And this is before cell phones were ubiquitous and I was the only one who had a pager. So there was no one to contact. So I'm at this competition and the other two girls aren't there. And the guy's like, you guys are up next. So I went up on stage by myself and just talked for 10 minutes. And had the crowd in the palm of my hand. And then people kept coming up to me afterwards going, you don't need those two other girls. You are a stand-up comic. And I was like, what is this stand-up comedy that they speak of? And then I started researching that. And then I was like, oh, I am a stand-up comic. And that's basically how I became a comedian. And I was like, well, I'll do this for fun for 6 months. And then, because it's the summer and I'm enjoying the summer, I'll do this comedy thing. And then come winter, when my money runs out, I'll go back to engineering. But I never went back to engineering. Comedy took off. And 27 years later, whatever it is, I'm still here.
I fucking love that a theme in your life seems to be, oh, I guess I'll do this and bye-bye to that. And then I think there's something to like believing in yourself enough to be like, this is what I want and this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I'm a gung-ho kind of person. I go for something and I throw everything at it. If it fails, I go, well, I did everything I could to make this successful. Next. And then I move on. I don't care. And that's how I've always been. I've gone, fuck it, I'll try this. Yeah, my motto in life is, fuck it, give it a go.
Yeah.
And that's how I've always been. And so that's how comedy works for me. I was like, I love this. I'm going to throw everything I can at it. I want to be the best at it.
I think a lot of people could learn from that. because I think a lot of people are just scared of failure. And then it's like, well, if you don't fail, then how do you ever figure out how to succeed?
Exactly. I'm not scared of failure. I mean, I'm scared, not scared of failure. I don't want to fail.
Yeah, you don't want to fail, but like, if it happens, it happens. Like, when I started doing comedy, I was like so afraid of bombing. And then the first bomb I had, I was like, meh, that wasn't that bad. I'll figure it out to do better next time. So then you kind of embrace the bombs. You learn.
Yeah.
Is your family supportive, or were they supportive in the beginning of your comedy career?
Absolutely not. My mother is an African woman. Immigrant mentality is like, you know, I used to do a joke where I go, in an African family, you've got only a few choices of career. Doctor, lawyer, engineer, accountant, disgrace to the family. Those are the choices. And I was an engineer, so I was on the list. And then my mum's like, hold on. You are leaving engineering to become a clown. What the hell is this? What am I going to tell my, you know? So she was not impressed. She was not happy. And the way I sold it to her, I was like, listen, Mom, I'm already a qualified engineer. I can walk into a job anytime I want. I'm going to do this and see how it pans out. And if it doesn't work, I will still be an engineer. I will never not be an engineer. And so my mom was like, fine, do your clown business and then go and get a proper job later. And then, but then I got on television. Within 6 months of starting comedy, I got on this huge nationally shown competition. It's like a talent competition. And it was hosted by a guy called Jonathan Ross, who is our version of a Leno or a Fallon or a Kim. You know what I mean? Big show. And so once I got on this show with Jonathan Ross, that validated everything. And then furthermore, my mum came to the show because I got through to the final. She won't come to the semi-final. She's like, if you get through to the final, I will come. So she comes to the final and Jonathan Ross points her out and my mum stands up on television in full view of the world with her arms up like that going, yes, I am the one. I am the reason this one is a clown. If it wasn't for me.
This one is a clown.
So after that, after I was on TV, it validated everything for her. Mm-hmm. And she's been nothing but supportive ever since.
I mean, sometimes you gotta get some success before people get behind you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is kind of a bummer, but also not a I don't know how to articulate it other than like sometimes you just have to prove to people that you can do it before they're like, okay. All right.
And the immigrant mentality, my mom came to England, sacrificed the success that she had in Nigeria to give us a better life in England. So as far as she was concerned, I didn't make all these sacrifices for you to squander it on bullshit, you know? Mm-hmm. That was her mentality.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So you have a birthmark on your neck.
I do.
And I read that your grandmother...
Yes.
...had... wait, what did I read? So, okay. According to a family superstition, your grandmother was poisoned by her jealous sister wives and marked with a spot on her neck. And you have you have a similar birthmark to the spot on her neck that she was marked with.
Yes, I'm a reincarnation of her.
Okay.
I am her. And you know what? Whenever I've gone to psychics, they always say the same thing. There was an older lady guiding you in your life. Every single psychic I've ever gone to has always said the same thing. There's a woman guiding, there's an older woman guy, and I know that is my grandmother. So, and here's the story. I mean, I'm spiritual, and I believe, and these are stories that have been passed out. My mum told me these stories that when my mum was a little girl, her mother used to say, because she was married, she had 11 kids, she was one of several wives, and she was like, and she used to say to my mum when she was a kid, she's like, when I come back, because we believe strongly in reincarnation, she'd be like, when I come back, I'm going to be speaking English. Because Nigeria is a British colony, so, I'm going to be speaking English, perfect English. I'm going to be English, and I'm not going to have all these children. I don't want to let, because she had 11 children. I don't want a man. I don't want children. I'm going to live my life in freedom. If I want to, I will do a man's job. I will live. And these are the things that she used to say. Mm-hmm. Then she's murdered because she's the most powerful wife, and her kids were more beloved than the other wife's kids. So she was poisoned. When she was poisoned, she died with a mark on her throat. And remember, she always kept saying, I'm going to come back as this, that, and the other. Then I'm born, and I am a walking embodiment of everything that she said she was going to be.
You don't got a man. You were working a job that a man had.
Two jobs that men had.
Yeah, like, you do what you want to do, and you live your life. That's so fucking cool. I believe in shit like that, and I like that.
My mother doesn't call me by my name. My nickname is Granny because I'm my own grandmother. My mother calls me Granny. That is my nickname in my family and has been since I was a child. Granny.
I love that. That's fucking adorable. Come on, Granny. And then in walks a child. Like, is it time for my snack?
Exactly. And it helped me when I had to come out to my mom because she was not happy about the lesbianity as a Nigerian staunch Christian, and all I had to say was, but mom, I am your mother, and this is what she wanted. I've come out exactly what your mother wanted. I am your mom. So she said she was going to come out not needing any man. No, I am that.
I don't need any man. So,
and my mom was like, she couldn't say shit.
That's so fucking funny. She's like, I want to hate this, but like, I literally can't. All right, Gita, thank you so much for doing this. What would you like to promote? You got a lot of shit going on. Tell the people.
Well, make sure you buy my book, Cat Candid, because the more detailed versions of these very stories I've told you are all in this book. And it is a good read. Even if I say so myself, It is actually a good book. I know. Listen, here's the thing. If you buy this book and you don't like it, email me at info@jeannieashleigh.com and I'll give you your money back. There you go. It's a win-win. I'll give you the money back if you buy this book and you don't like it, because I know you're going to love it. And, you know, make sure you watch my show, Bob Hart's Abby Schola, Monday nights on CBS at 8:30 p.m. Please watch the show. Fourth season, we've been picked up. And I know we don't get the cool factor that the Insecures and the Abbott Elementaries get, because they're, you know, they're cooler, younger shows. But our show is fucking good. So watch it.
You also have a Netflix special, yes?
Oh, I have several Netflix specials now. Shoot, I mean, two of them are older. Like, I sold them. Two specials I made myself with my own money, because I won't wait for nobody. So one is called Skinny Bitch, because I was bigger and I lost weight, and people were, every time I got on stage, audiences would just break into conversations. How did she do it? What's happened? Is she ill? Is she on crystal meth? What is it? So I called the special Skinny Bitch, and the first few minutes is explaining, I lost the weight because I had lupus and I did things. So that one's called Skinny Bitch. There's another one that I made in San Francisco in 2012 called Laughing to America. And then I'm also on season 2 of The Stand-Ups. Yeah. On Netflix. So I'm all over the Netflixes. Go watch my specials.
You're all over. God, Tasha, I love it. Okay, if you write me a dirty message, I will read it. Put this in your ear holes. Nicole, I'd happily hire the hottest man I could find to come to your house, shove a dozen cronuts into your favorite luscious crevice, skewer them with that famous monster cock, then pull the whole flaky mess out and feed it to you while you made hamster noises. You know? I don't even know. Oh, I guess I go, that's cute. I like that. That's nice. And I've never had a cronut, so... That's nice of you. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for Why Won't You Date Me with me, Nicole Byer. Why Won't You Date Me is produced and engineered by, the sweetest woman I know, Marissa Melnick. It is executive produced by other wonderful people, Adam Sachs, Joanna Solo-Taroff, and Jeff Ross. Thanks for listening. I love you. Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you next Friday with a brand new episode. What a treat. What a dream.
This has been a Team Coco production.